This show was previously broadcast live on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome to the Godspeed Institute, an enlightening and positive forum exploring the world's religions and spiritual practices in an effort to better understand each other, promote tolerance, and foster human unity. We present views and experiences of the world's religions and spiritual belief systems as an on-air classroom, helping listeners gain insight into religious and spiritual practices around the world, and to help people find tools and inspiration for their own spiritual development. I'm your host, Carol Hollenbeck. Today, we will be exploring a mainstream Christian Protestant denomination, specifically the Methodist Church and the United Methodist Tradition. With us to help us better understand this topic, we're pleased to welcome Dr. Thomas E. Frank, Professor of Religious Leadership and Administration and Coordinator of the Initiative in Religious Practices and Practical Theology at Emory University. Dr. Frank's primary interest is the history, congregational life, and organizational culture of mainstream Protestant denominations. He is the author of numerous books, including two books on United Methodism, Episcopacy in the United Methodist Tradition, Perspectives and Proposals, and Polity, Practice, and the Mission of the United Methodist Church. He was the principal writer and consultant for the United Methodist Bishop's Pastoral Letter and Episcopal Teaching Statement on Vital Congregations, Faithful Disciples, and has explored the relationship of Protestant Christianity and the liberal arts. Dr. Frank is a graduate of Harvard, Candler, and Emory Universities, and has, in addition, recently completed a master's degree in heritage preservation at Georgia State in preparation for research and writing on the preservation of historic religious buildings. Welcome, Dr. Frank, and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted.
It's a very interesting series of things that you're involved with, and perhaps we can touch on a few different things. I'm interested in, the preservation of historic buildings, the liberal arts, and such.
Sure.
But first, perhaps to better understand the Methodist tradition, the best place to start would be to help us understand the roots of the church. Where did it come from? How it began? Its history and origins?
Sure. Methodism is a child of the Church of England. It started as a movement in the 18th century, led by a very well-known person in his day and still quite an interesting fellow, John Wesley.
Yes.
And Wesley's life basically spanned the 18th century, which is really a fascinating period of time. If you think about it, it's the period of the Enlightenment in Europe,
yes,
as well as a very widespread evangelical revival. And
now,
elements of both of those things were integrated into the Methodist movement.
And how did it become a movement in the first place?
Well, he was a priest in the Church of England. He was an ordained Anglican priest and quite faithful to his tradition. In fact, after his education at Oxford, he actually came to Georgia as the first Anglican priest in the colony in Savannah. And he only lasted about 18 months, but that was his first taste of parish priesthood, and then
18 months.
it didn't go so well.
What happened?
He had a little romance that ended badly with the woman that he thought, I guess he was fantasizing, would marry him. Told him that she was marrying someone else, And he followed that action by banning her from the communion table. He wouldn't let her come to the basic Christian sacrament.
Goodness.
And her father became quite agitated and went to the sheriff or whoever in Savannah at the time. And so Wesley left under cover of night. And he, interestingly enough, he never came back to the United States. He was never in America again.
Hmm. Well, things can get tough over here.
That's right. So he went back to England, and of course he was a very well-educated man. He spoke, read several languages. He kept up with the literature of his day, and perhaps chastened by his Georgia experience, he began a most remarkable life. He became convinced that there was need for people to discover a personal relationship with God and to, as he continually put it, grow in the knowledge and love of God. And he wanted to organize people in a way that they could sustain that Christian life over time. So he and some friends from Oxford had started reading in the 1720s. They had read a lot of the ancient Christian writings, particularly the writings of people who had founded monastic movements. And he thought that the Christians of his own day could learn a lot from these ancient monks, and in terms of spiritual exercises, patterns of daily living that would enable you to grow and closeness with God. And so he kind of adapted those spiritual disciplines, what we today call spiritual disciplines. He tried to adapt them for the everyday life of people in his own time and culture. So he organized what he gradually began to call a society, which is what we might call a voluntary association or something like that, an organization of people who were mostly baptized Christians in the National Church of England, but they were looking for something more, and he organized them into local societies, and then those local societies were organized into small groups, and so typically it would be a neighborhood group of 12 with a class leader, and he called these class meetings, and they would meet weekly, and the class leader would guide the meeting, and they would do a lot of soul searching, reading scripture together, praying together, and talking about their lives, and then give an offering for the poor, and then they would go out to try to live a holy life during the intervening time until the next class meeting. So that was kind of a pattern that he established in many places in England. And it made Methodism a profoundly lay movement in that sense. It wasn't a movement primarily among priests. It was a movement among lay people.
Well, I can relate to that in my own background, in my own studies of the... Yeah. Saints and monastics, let's say, in the Catholic Church. My second book, Saints and Love, explores similar ideas that would have inspired him. And also, for example, the Franciscans created a third order, which was their lay order, which is, where you didn't become a brother or a monk. You stayed in your home with your family and basically... Yeah. Found a way to turn everyday life into prayer, because it's all sacred.
I call it a kind of secular monasticism.
It's
trying to follow the monastic way of life, but also lead an everyday life with a job and family and.
Yeah, exactly.
And but it's fascinating to me how much this is still current. I mean, the fascination with this. Rediscovery of spiritual disciplines and the formation of small groups that's put forward now as a key to the vitality of Christian churches. And this was also the key to vitality in the 18th century, I think you could say.
Yes, it's an important thing to, I think, to almost learn to sanctify the home again, because mm-hmm. faith, most faiths yeah. begin there originally, wind up in a building where people go to
right.
1 hour a week or thereabouts, yeah. and it can separate then the idea that, religion and faith, it doesn't start at home with our own families and, the parents in the home as authority figures and such. I perceive a movement heading back in that direction even today,
yeah.
but obviously John Wesley and his fellows sensed it back then. So let us know a little more then. Where does the word Methodist come from? What is the method?
Well, it was actually a derogatory term. Many people think that it was a term used by people who didn't like it very much. And they thought that they were kind of being sarcastic that Wesley was being methodical, and not only that, but believed in the methods of these spiritual disciplines, such that by practicing them you would be saved. And of course, that was the opposite of what Wesley was saying. He was not saying that by practicing spiritual disciplines, you were saving yourself. He was saying that was an opportunity to bring your life in closer harmony with God, and therefore to receive the benefits of God's grace. So that was his theme. So, but then he just kind of adopted it and gave up and used the term. So at least that's the popular version of it. No, I'm not sure anybody really knows exactly how the term came about. You mentioned a Catholic order, and I think we should balance the lay movement theme and the small group theme with the fact that one of the disciplines was certainly to continue to attend church. Some spiritual renewal movements turn out to be kind of anti-church, or
right.
They alienate people from church. And Wesley was a devout Anglican all his life. He wasn't trying to start a separate church, and he
right.
He,
neither was Luther.
And he felt that Methodists should go receive sacraments, at least every week, preferably more often. And to do that, you'd have to go to the services conducted by the priests in the Church of England.
Now, how was there any opposition? As you said, this is a child of the Church of England. I'm not sure if the Church of the Anglican Church would be open to having a sort of sub church within it. How did that work out in terms of the structure of things? And
a lot of anger and hostility, actually, as you can well imagine. Church of England was a national church, which means that every square inch of England was in a parish. Didn't mean that everybody went to church, but
right.
but the entire land was divided into parishes. Well, Wesley was organizing these class meetings, and he was also authorizing people to preach in public places to kind of call them to a renewal of faith, and at the end of their sermon they would invite people to the Methodist meetings to sustain this. So the preaching went alongside the class meetings, and the preachers were mostly lay people. There were a handful of ordained, but they were mostly lay people. Well, you can imagine a parish priest discovering that some layperson is standing on the steps of the town cross, which is typically at the center of the market in an English town, and preaching, on his territory. So, no, it was not well received, and sometimes they would preach standing on a tombstone up against the wall of the parish church, because that gave you a backdrop for your voice and you could be heard. And you might have several hundred people, sometimes thousands of people would gather to hear Wesley, and he was always in somebody's parish. So he He uttered a phrase that's become quite famous in Methodism, and many people think it's the most characteristic Methodist phrase, and that is, the world is my parish.
Mm.
And what he meant was that the message is too important to be contained in parishes, the message of coming closer to God through God's grace as known in Jesus Christ is too important not to just be proclaimed everywhere. So that was his theme, and he upset a lot of people, but that didn't really bother him that much, I don't think.
No.
He was a prolific writer of tracts and letters. He wrote in his journal every day and published his journal every few years. It was actually published for the public to read, so that he was perhaps one of the most published men of the 18th century.
And for that time frame, that's almost like being a blogger.
Yes, exactly. Almost, you know, many dozens of his sermons, his journal, hundreds of letters that they appeared in print, that was a basic way to teach. And then another piece of writing that shouldn't be omitted is what he and his brother Charles did. They were two of the 19 children that their parents gave birth to, and some of whom lived into adulthood, but John and Charles lived into ripe old age, and Charles was an astounding hymn writer. He wrote over 6,000 hymns, with many of them with 15 to 25 or 30 verses, and they're actually quite good for what they are. They're quite good poetry. He had a real genius for language, and so the hymns also became part of the kind of published record of Methodism that began to spread.
Yes, very important too. So John Wesley, he came to the U.S. and he did get his heart broken and decided to look inward in the monastic tradition to find closer relationship with God, which of course creates evangelism and the fire for God and to spread the word everywhere, not contained in a parish. His words, "The world is my parish," actually, that's a very, very powerful phrase, and it's, I think, for all time. It began that way, and it's, you know, heading that way to me, out of the temple, as in the Bible, and our spirituality being lived out fully, publicly, with each other. So now how then, since he never came back here, how did the Methodist Church come then to be established in the United States and develop here?
Well, it's intriguing, actually, because Methodism actually was never that big in England. A lot of American Methodists just assumed that it swept over England like wildfire, but it really didn't. There were never more than less than 1% of the English people were ever actually in Methodist societies. Yet he was a huge public figure because of all these publications. Well, Methodism was very strong in the port cities of England, London, Newcastle, and Bristol, which form a kind of triangle in the English-British Isles.
Yep.
And Wesley kind of traveled that triangle as he rode horseback all over the country and preached often 18 or 20 times a week. So a lot of people heard him preach. A lot of people gathered in these Methodist societies, particularly in these port towns. And then it was the era of settlement in America. So in the early 1760s or so, some lay people who'd been part of Methodist societies in England found themselves on boats coming to America. And naturally, when they landed in New York, for example, they decided they wanted to start a Methodist society here. And since it was a lay movement to a great extent. They just started their own class meetings trying to use the materials they carried with them in their bags from England. And then that gradually picked up pace, and some people who were experienced preachers in England began to arrive in America. And it spread that way. There's actually quite a dispute over which class meeting was the first one. As you can imagine, once a movement reaches a certain age, you have a battle over the correct myth of origins, but it was probably New York, being a big port, so forth. But then the leader that emerged out of that early period was another intriguing fellow, not quite the Renaissance man that Wesley was, but equally tireless, and that was Francis Asbury, who became one of the best-known early Americans. I mean, he started preaching in the 1760s in America. He then became the leader of the American Methodist movement when it had to separate from England in the wake of the Revolutionary War. And then he was really the linchpin of the movement all through until his death in the 1830s. So he's the other kind of key person to follow, because he preached absolutely everywhere. He rode by horseback all over colonial America, particularly.
Is that what they
call
the circuit riders?
Yes. Well, he set the pattern for them by being constantly on horseback, and then he began to assign preachers to cover the growing territory. He obviously couldn't do all that himself, typically you'd have one preacher to cover a territory of about 30 miles in diameter, which is pretty good distance on horseback.
Right.
And so this began the tradition that was sort of epitomized in the phrase the circuit rider, the literally riding around a circuit of Methodist class meetings. And when the circuit rider appears, then of course you have more of a worship service. That brought preaching to the foreground, really, of Methodism. These preaching events were often the central social activity of a frontier community. So it spread very quickly because people wanted to come hear the preacher. And then, of course, a class meeting gave you kind of a social center for your life. I mean, it was a place to gather with people in a sometimes very lonely life of farming in unsettled territory. So I think of it as this early period is when the Methodist clock was set. That is, the class meeting would meet every week, and the circuit rider would come around every month, and then an elder or priest, in the Methodist terminology was called an elder, would come around once a quarter and have the sacrament of Holy Communion.
Right.
So that became the clock that the laity were accustomed to. And
right.
Even when I was a kid growing up in the Methodist Church, people still talked about the quarterly conference, by which they meant a time when the presiding elder would come around and celebrate communion and hold
yes,
a conference
it has
with the members of that congregation.
It has a distinctly American feel to it, you know,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
With the vast land to be traveled, you know, by pioneers, as it were, and in this case, spiritual pioneers.
Yeah. One thing that Asbury continued that I've always been fascinated with, you know, I said that John Wesley was a kind of Renaissance man, and I mean, he was interested in everything. He wrote a whole book about health and I forget the whole title, but he used the word physic in it, which was the 18th century word for physiology. Or,
right.
You know, he had cures for everything. He even tried a primitive form of electric shock therapy.
Wow.
He was quite the experimenter. Asbury, I don't recall him having that much interest in science, but he loved the land. And when you read his journal, he makes the most intriguing comments about the land of America. I mean, he was one of the first Europeans to see the land in many cases. I mean, he was coming around when the settlements were brand new, and he would often comment on how beautiful a valley was, or he'd list the types of trees that he saw, or he'd comment on the height of the water in the creeks, because he had to ford them. Or one of my favorites is that a Methodist greets him in a village in West Virginia and takes him on a ride. He rides about 2 extra miles up into the mountains to go look in a cave. And they go into this cave and explore the cave and sing a hymn inside the cave, which, of course, is a wonderful sound when you sing inside a cave. So there's little things like that that just, you know, kind of show his love of the land. So I've always thought that Methodism kind of paired a passion for spiritual growth with a love of nature, in the sense of a love for the life that God has given us, so that you know, God gives us this creation for our enjoyment and fruitfulness, and therefore we are, you know, deeply responsible for it, to both enjoy it, try to absorb it, wonder at it, and to care for it. And I think that's a companion piece to our continued search for God, and maybe a way in which we continue to discover God.
And part of that passion that you just mentioned, I think also there's a great diversity of opinion and thought within the Methodist Church, and John Wesley welcomed diversity of thought and was, you know, making appeals for tolerance of diversity of theological opinion. And he said a great thing. He said, though we may not think alike, may we not all love alike?
Yes.
Can you share with us a little bit about this diversity of thought in the Methodist tradition, and also has it created different factions within the church?
Well, there you go. Let me go back to the first part of that. Wesley, it really does begin with Wesley's kind of spirit. He preached a terrific sermon. I think it's really, I suppose all Methodist preachers think they have an all-time sermon. You know, yeah. And I think Wesley's, I don't know if he would have said
this. At least
this,
one, I hope.
But for me, his all-time sermon was called Catholic Spirit, which should be the small c, meaning
yes.
Global or worldwide.
Yes, universal.
The universal spirit. And he, the gist of that was pretty much along the lines of what you said a minute ago, that there's a phrase in there, if your heart is with my heart, then take my hand. And he was basically saying, look, there are some basics of Christian teaching that if we didn't have them, we really couldn't be Christians. And for that, he turned to basically to the creeds. He was a good Anglican, so he turned to the Apostles' Creed and the Nicene Creed as the source
right.
of Christian teaching. But then he said, beyond that, there's tremendous diversity in kind of the way we do things. For example, the way we do baptisms. Some branches do infant baptism. Some do adult baptism. Some sprinkle. Some immerse. Kind of, so what? You know, that doesn't have to be a dividing mark. It doesn't mean that my congregation's right and yours is wrong, or that you should come join mine. It just means that we can be sisters and brothers in the Christian faith and beyond on the basis of our basic Christianity. He had another essay that he published called The Character of a Methodist, in which he kind of outlined what Methodists teach and how they live. And at the end of it, he said, I realized that this looks like there's really nothing different about a Methodist. And he said, you're right, there isn't. It's
right.
Not really different. It's just basic Christianity. And so if Methodism's a way in which you can grow in basic Christianity, come on and join us. If it's not, you know, stay in your own congregation, but continue to practice these basic forms of life. So that really opened the door to a huge diversity in Methodist practice that still exists. I mean, you can go to today, you can go to a United Methodist Church in America today. You can go to one that you would think is Episcopalian. I mean, it uses all the standard prayers, and the minister's wearing an alb or something very formal, or you know, and you have the communion every Sunday, and you can go to a Methodist church where the preacher's in jeans and a pullover shirt and has video screens and guitars and drums in the band, and you know, it's really all over the place. Liturgically, and yet everyone feels that they have a place in the tent of Methodism.
Yes, the spiritual expression as diverse as the communities.
Yeah, and if you think about it, that really goes back to the beginnings, because it was a kind of an evangelical movement within an established church. So the formal liturgy is almost identical to the Book of Common Prayer of the Church of England or the Episcopal Church U.S. And it's almost the same, and that's also combined then with this much more evangelical element based on preaching and on a desire for the personal experience of God, which has leads to a different kind of worship. And so these live side by side in one tradition.
Very good, very good. We are going to take just a short break now.
Okay.
Thomas, stay with us. We like to showcase new and interesting music on Godspeed, and this piece is called Les Fers d'Afrique by the artist Philippe Mangold. Stay with us. Thank you. Welcome back to the Godspeed Institute. I'm your host, Carol Hallenbeck. We're talking about the Methodist tradition with Dr. Thomas Frank, Professor of Religious Leadership and Administration and Coordinator of the Initiative in Religious Practices and Practical Theology at Emory University. Welcome back, Doctor.
Thank you.
I'd like to discuss something that's very central, of course, in the Methodist faith and the Christian faith, and important personally to me, which is the subject of grace.
Yes.
If you wouldn't mind getting into a little theology now, theology of grace in the
sure.
in the Methodist tradition.
Well, it's really the signature teaching of Methodism. I think from Wesley's time to the present, it's very central. There's really no doctrinal difference or distinction of Methodism and the larger Catholic or certainly Anglican form of Christianity. As I said, the creeds and the Book of Common Prayer are very much in the background of Methodism and still in a certain form or shape it. And Methodism has been very active in the ecumenical movement and has adopted a lot of the forms of liturgy and prayer that have developed out of conversation among Christian traditions. But what's really distinctive is the accent that Methodists put on grace. That is to say that grace is God's great offer to us to transform our lives and open up new possibilities for us to live new lives and to be an influence for good in the world. And much of our song, our prayers, our worship in Methodism is oriented towards seeking God's grace. Doctrinally, of course, Methodism joins with the whole Catholic Christian tradition in the teaching of original sin, that humanity falls short of the image of God with which we were created. But that presents the great need for God's grace in our lives, and it's a very central teaching of Methodism that we don't have to do anything to merit God's grace except to seek it and to receive it and to respond to it. And so Methodists teach that God's grace goes before us. Wesley called it prevenient, going before grace, preceding us and helping us to turn toward God, and then justifying and sanctifying us to lead this new life. I mentioned the spiritual disciplines before that Wesley wrote about. He didn't use that language. That's contemporary language. The language he used was the means of grace. That is,
yes.
He taught that if you read Scripture carefully, that if you discussed it with your fellow seekers, that if you went to a worship service and heard the Word of God proclaimed, if you received the sacrament of Holy Communion, if you gave alms to the poor and so forth, that these were the means through which God has promised that God's grace will be given to us. So that's what we can do to respond, is to put ourselves in a position to receive what God has to give us. And then if that's the basis of everything, then it really changes it changes your outlook on the world. For example, Methodists have some pretty firm moral teachings about the continuing human sin of allowing so many of our sisters and brothers to live in destitution and poverty or failing to provide health care to people who have no access to it, or devastating our environment and so forth. There's many evidences of human shortcomings, but at least if we're faithful to our own tradition as Methodists, we don't talk about this as our sort of moral duty to fix it. Instead, we talk about it as that we get involved in, for example, helping the poor or visiting prisoners in the county jail. We get involved in that as a response to God's love, because God has loved us. And so, you know, we're not trying to prove anything or fix anything.
Right.
We're certainly not trying to earn our own way to heaven. But God has given us so much that the least we can do is give back. And
yes.
I think that's a real driver in for Methodists theologically, and explaining kind of why we do what we do.
And that sanctifying grace, encouraging the response then. A picture came to mind as you were describing this. I actually went back a little to something you were saying earlier about the gentleman who was so struck by the land.
Mm-hmm.
And this mental image came to me of these three ways of grace operating in life. Can I share it?
Sure.
I had this image of a field, and prevenient grace being that which can plow and prepare the soil,
uh-huh.
and the justifying grace being your, you know, planting of seeds,
yeah.
and the sanctifying grace then, of course, allowing the growth and for us to blossom and flower, to be seen in the world.
Yeah.
We don't normally really explore in general, you know, the different ways grace can be operating
mm-hmm.
in our lives. And
that's a lovely image. It is, I think, yeah, the best way to talk about it is as a something that surrounds our whole lives in Methodist teachings and becomes the heart of what Methodists want to witness to. And we ought to say something about that word, too, because it's been very significant in Methodism to speak of our witness and service. And it doesn't mean just talking to people, which is what witness gets reduced to that, I think, in a lot of Protestant groups or Protestant ways of speaking. Lots of times to give witness is to tell somebody something. And, you know, there's sometimes an element of that, but I think it's more powerfully put that if your life is a witness to God's grace, then use words only if necessary.
Mm.
Let people see what God's grace means for the world. And
now,
that means that you've given your time to help build a house, or you've gotten on a plane and gone to Haiti to help out, or you know, any number of things.
And this living out of the fullness of faith brings to mind: does the Methodist Church have an understanding of saints as other Protestant traditions may have?
Not formally, no. That's part of the Anglican tradition that was not carried over into America. I think there was a kind of fear. That was a period where there was a lot of, to be candid, anti-Catholic sentiment.
Right.
in Protestantism, even though it was 200 years after the Reformation, there was still a fear of falling into a kind of hierarchical church, and I think worship of the saints was seen as almost a form of subjugation, you know, keeping the believer tied up with unimportant rites and rituals, and,
right?
You know, kind of misguiding them. So there was a real fear of that. I can recall even in my own youth, people with kind of overtones that you know, paying attention to the saints was kind of a sidelight to real Christianity. And the important thing was how you know, lived your life in the world. Well, I think that's changed a lot, and people have discovered a more integrated way to think about this, which is that, you know, the saints can be a model for how to live that life in the world.
Yeah.
Or maybe better put, that we can learn from their struggle to live that life.
Right.
Almost more than thinking of them as a model. So there's more appreciation for it, but it hasn't found its way in formally into you know, books of worship or that sort of thing. Where in the Book of Common Prayer, for example, you have the saints' days are all listed as
right.
There's special prayers for them and that sort of thing. So, but I think a rebirth of interest in it, just as there's a rebirth of interest in what we can learn from ancient monasticism.
Can you share a little bit about this is called the United Methodist Church, and it brings to question then, what is united, or what wasn't before?
Yeah, well, we still ask ourselves that, actually. I often ask my classes, what's united about United Methodism?
Mm.
Because we are so diverse, and there's often some degree of conflict among the different factions. But it was a church union, interestingly enough, between the predominantly Anglo, meaning English, Scotch-Irish heritage of the church, and the predominantly German heritage. And then added to that was the long-standing heritage of African-American participation in Methodism, which really began in colonial days, including African-American preachers and African-American camp meetings. Methodism spread very widely, in other words, among a variety of ethnic groups, which eventuated in different denominational traditions. But in 1968, the branches that had been at one time actually German in background and with German language hymn books and German language worship services and so on at one time, the Evangelical and United Brethren Church then joined the Methodist Church and it took the name United Methodist. So the 20th century was a century of church unions. It brought together a lot of different Methodist branches into one. There was another church union in 1939 that brought other branches together, so that the one piece that still has never been reconciled, I mean, the most dominant one to me, is that there are still three major Methodist traditions that are African American.
Yes, let's share more about that.
The AME, African Methodist Episcopal Church, the AME Zion, and the Christian Methodist Episcopal Church, CME, those three are still independent denominations. And we've had talks year after year for a long time about the possibility of becoming one denomination and what a great witness that would be to the unity of peoples. But the challenge is, how do you achieve justice in such a church? If you bring that diverse a group together, how do you assure that everybody has the appropriate access to, say, being elected to office, being elected a bishop, or receiving a good pastoral appointment? You know, behind that is the whole social injustice that, endures in America. The U.S. has an enormous disparity between people of color and people of Anglo heritage, that persists to this day, and it's reflected in the churches, the African-American churches. The pastoral salaries are lower, the church facilities are often in poor condition, the lay people average income is less. So if the churches could all get together, you know, it would be a tremendous act of social justice.
If I may, back in the 18th century, you know, a gentleman, Absalom Jones, a former slave who became a lay minister for the black members of St. George's Methodist Church, and then was ordained the first African-American priest in the Episcopal Church. It just brings to mind all that we've been discussing with the Catholic small c, you know, universal, and the basic Christianity you spoke of earlier. Is there a way of uniting if this is basic Christianity? Do you foresee in the future the at least Christian, all the many Christian Protestant denominations in the U.S. Possibly moving toward unity?
Yeah, there's been a dream of this among many of us for a long time. I actually, at the beginning of my career, was very active in a movement that had started in the late 1950s, I believe. A consultation on church union, which had nine major denominations, including the three African-American denominations that I just mentioned. And the Episcopal Church, United Church of Christ, I mean, it was very ambitious. And, and at that time, the thought was that maybe these churches could actually find a way to either unite institutionally or at least have agreements for mutual recognition so that the ordinations and baptisms particularly would be recognized among all of them. Even that has been difficult to achieve. A lot of the steam has gone out of that movement because I think of generational change more than anything.
Well, you know, it's interesting. People, I think, today are very fired up about interreligious dialogue and reaching out to those, you know, Christians reaching out to Buddhists, Jews, Muslims, and going in that direction. Sometimes, though, it's talking to the people in your own house that's the hardest, and I think the Christian denominations definitely struggle with that.
And of course, groups like Methodism have such old roots the U.S. so that we all have this huge institutional overhead, kind of, if I could put it that way. It's not clear what to do with all that. You know, if you try to put it all together, how do you make it manageable? So the solution that we've been trying is to get everyone to recognize each other's teachings as authentic Christianity and our ordinations as a legitimate form of authority and so on. And we've made a lot of progress. The United Methodism and Lutheranism have recently reached an agreement.
Yes, and I think around 1999 or 2000, the Lutheran and the Episcopal Church also moved closer together in relationship.
So,
it's a fascinating journey.
It is. And so I think there's a lot of common ground. Many challenges, some of which come from the fact that in some ways these are not easy times for these older denominations because of that institutional overhead and Our overall church membership is not as strong as it once was. So there's a feeling of a kind of a feeling of decline that perhaps even more sharp than the reality. And so people tend to turn inward and try to think, well, how are we? You know, how do we revitalize our own tradition? Mm-hmm. And that the energy goes there instead of trying to figure out how to get together.
So. Right. Well, and John Wesley did it, and we'll do it again, right?
That's right. That's right. You know.
As we come to the end of our program today, can you tell us where people can learn more about Methodism and the United Methodist Church?
Sure. There's actually a very good website, umc.org. That has several pages in it on Methodist history and the story of the United Methodist Church. And then there's a whole section on how the United Methodists understand their mission in the world, what the church is called to do these days. And then lots of reports on church activities currently.
Terrific.
Such as the response to the earthquake in Haiti.
Oh, great. Thank you. And thank you for being with us today, Dr. Frank. There's so much to discuss. Perhaps we can speak again in the future.
That would be great. I'd enjoy it. Thank you so much.
I would enjoy it, too. It's been a wonderful hour. And thank you, listeners, for joining us for the Godspeed Institute today. We hope you enjoyed the program and hope you will join us again as we continue to explore the world's religions and spiritual belief systems right here on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Carol Hallenbeck. Until then, Godspeed.